Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week, highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
This week, we want to present an excerpt from the final two programs of the Community Journalism Workshop conducted with WPEB. The participants presented collective works and teams produced entirely by themselves. The first audio, on harm reduction and resilience, is from the team made up of Lone Nguyen, Jody Nicole, Alyssa Frieden, Amanda Berg, and Marcelo Jauregui-Volpe.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is WPEB's special show that's part of the Scrap Radio Project on the Community News Reporting Workshop that I've been on. My name is Long.
Hi, my name is Jody.
The first story that you'll be hearing today is interviewed by me. I was struck by a question that I didn't yet know the answer to for myself. It was posed by Paloma, and it's, what is my birth story?
Could you give me an introduction about who you are?
My name is Paloma. I've been working as a doula for 2.5 years. Yeah, this work for me started from a place of like a very personal way, because it's because my sister got pregnant, and it's what inspired me to take my first workshop, and the rest just sort of like developed on its own, really.
Where are you from in Philadelphia?
I am based in Southwest Philly, and I've been living here for about 5 or 6 years now.
What power do we gain by knowing our own birth stories?
I think that you learn a lot about relationships when you think about your birth story. I feel like for me, learning about my birth story is like connecting to my mom in a very different way, and connecting to my parents in a different way, just knowing about the stresses that they were dealing with, about the difficulties, and how in a lot of ways, those moments that were like in my like tender beginnings, right? Those were moments where I was absorbing so much and learning so much about my relationships, about my parents. And so much of it is like, it's overlooked because we were newborns, right? So we think that we don't remember things. So we're not carrying anything still. But I find that especially in learning more about my mom's postpartum period, I find that there are a lot of things that I absorbed in that time, even if I don't have memories about them. So yeah, so I feel like it's learning about how my life started, and how many of the things that I know about today, whether they're good things or negative things about myself, sometimes I can like track them back to that moment. And so much of it is about support too, because I think in like the struggles that I've had with my relationship with my mother, a lot of it can be traced back to that beginning time that she didn't have the support that she needed. And like, you know, as a birth worker, that's what I encounter a lot, like trying to make sure that the parents that I work with are supported and have that community so that they don't feel so alone. And so they don't feel like the pressure of the world when it comes to having a newborn that you're responsible for.
Can you just give us a little more detail about what is that role for the mother while giving birth?
As a doula, I support the birthing person from pregnancy through to their postpartum time. This support is different from any other medical provider that you see. It's not, you can't really equate it to a doctor. It's not medical advice. You can't relate it to a midwife. You can't relate it to a nurse even. A nurse can sometimes fill that role of support because they're the person who's with you the most if you're giving birth in a hospital, but they're with 10 other people or who knows how many people they're working with at the same time. And with a doula, this is a person that you're working with from as early on in your pregnancy as you want, and who you're developing a relationship with, and you're teaching them, and like you're learning together how to best make you feel supported, because we all have different ways of feeling support. It's about having one person who specializes in you and who specializes in your care, a familiar face in the context of a hospital where there can be so many different people coming in and out. But even in a home birth, it's somebody who has been with you from the beginning and who knows what things might come up for you. Yeah. So that support, it's not medical. It's more emotional. It can be spiritual. It's definitely physical support. It can be a lot of hands-on support, whether it be like massage or like get helping you get from one position to another, to help labor progress. It's a way to honor and to acknowledge something that, you know, women have been doing for centuries, and that regardless of our access to those stories or those people for ourselves, there are still ways that we can honor that journey and acknowledge how major it is and how hard it can be for so many people.
Welcome to the truck to truck interviews. I'm sitting in a Ford Ranger and Billy is sitting in
a Mazda B3000.
I'm here today to talk with Billy about harm reduction. Billy, could you start off maybe by telling us about the kind of work that you do in the community before we get into that?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for talking with me about this. So I am a community organizer with an organization in Philly called Soul Collective. That's Soul, like S-O-L, like the sun in Spanish, but also it's an acronym that stands for Save Our Lives. We are a harm reduction organization, meaning we support people who use drugs, who do sex work, and who are living unhoused, housing unstable, sleeping rough in Philadelphia in a variety of different ways, but the kind of central ways are supporting people with sterile, safe supplies for drug use. And that's drug use across the various like forms of it. So not just what we might classically think of as like with like sterile syringes and supplies for injection, but also supplies for smoking and for snorting, to kind of expand beyond the like injection centric way of thinking about harm reduction. So we support people with supplies that they have expressly stated that they need, that will both support health and work to also prevent overdose. We provide folks with naloxone or Narcan, wound care supplies, and wound care from trained nurses and EMTs, and do overdose reversal trainings in the community, and do a lot of public education around the history and ongoing impact of the racist and specifically anti-Black war on drugs and the current overdose epidemic in Philly, but also obviously across the country.
So I wanted to talk to you because Soul Collective is a harm reduction organization. And I wanted to talk to you because I think that I have heard so many people kind of just throwing around the phrase harm reduction. And I'm not sure if we as a community of people truly understand what that means. Would you be able to speak about that a little bit more?
My understanding of this has definitely been shaped by, like, I would say just like a ton of ancestors and elders and current people in the movement who themselves are drug users, are sex workers, are unhoused people like living at the margins, who have really like shaped my understanding of this. So I just want to make sure that that's like clear, that I take like 0% credit for this analysis. Also, you can help us spread the word about our free naloxone mailing program. We've partnered with an organization called Next Distro that we work with in order to mail doses of Narcan, so the life-saving medication that reverses an opioid overdose. You can help us spread the word about how folks can get that mailed to any residence in Philadelphia completely free of charge. The mailing is like discreet and anonymous, and you can sign up to get a dose sent to you, or two doses sent to you, at Next, N-E-X-T, distro, D-I-S-T-R-O, .org/Philly. So tell people about that, especially people who might not have insurance or who are like less mobile, and specifically for people who live with or are themselves a person who is at risk of an overdose, which, because of the presence of fentanyl in drugs right now, extends beyond just people who use opioids and extends to people who might more casually use stimulants or something else too. We also can mail fentanyl testing strips to people who need them, in addition to Narcan. What else can you do to support Soul Collective? Just like boost our work, have us come train your workplace, your organization, whatever the case may be, in how to reverse overdoses, how to use Narcan, and how to like better understand the context of the racist drug war and overdose crisis in Philly, option two. All those things, you can hit us up on our Instagram, our Facebook, or our email at outreach@phillysoulcollective.org.
Jody interviews Jerry Hilt, an Afro-Indigenous artist who talks about how nurturing an intimate relationship with one's environment has the possibility to reverse the harms caused by extractive industries.
Hello, I'm here with Jerry Hilt, who is a creative director and art producer engaged in environmental restoration and advocacy, cultivation, and radical sustainability and Afro-Indigenous political initiatives. What does environmental intimacy entail?
Environmental intimacy is a term that I really developed to refer specifically to relationship and practice. And my hope was that by using term intimacy, people would begin to explore what their relationship to the natural world looked like. And I also wanted them to feel a certain amount of ownership over both the term and their relationship to the environmental world. This is an initiative that seeks to shift consciousness and reconnect specifically Black and Indigenous women to practices that are both innate and ancient and familiar, that for many of us have only largely shifted within very recent generations in reference to connection with the land.
How does the state of the environment relate to the health of communities on the Gulf Coast?
Well, specifically in Louisiana, there is an above average, arguably an inordinate number of oil refineries. It's one of our major industries, both the extraction of oil and the complicated chemical heavy process to clean it from crude oil into the petroleum that we use to power our cars and more. And there's a lot of environmental waste and environmental and toxic products that are a result of that process. That toxicity is often released into the air and carried by the wind.
Mm.
And so while there's not an overwhelming amount of research that correlates this toxic waste from oil refinery to direct health influences,
mm-hmm.
what we know is that there are radically increased pockets of cancer, both mm-hmm. in adults and in children,
mm-hmm.
not far up the river and up the wind trail paths
mm-hmm.
of some of these oil refineries in the state. So that's a much more corporate, large scale impact of health as it correlates to the environment. However, just the aggressive, indiscriminate extraction of oil already negatively impacts the coast and ecological balances. We've experienced this in very globally historic oil spills
mm.
on the coast that not only traumatize the environment, but poison the food source mm. coming out of the ocean. Of course, we know that everything, all the waterways in our region are connected. They're largely tributaries that feed from larger sources to smaller sources. And so anything happening in one space has the ability to carry over into other spaces through the connectivity and the water network.
When you envision the coastline coming back to itself, what does that look like to you?
I'm so glad you asked me that. Earlier this week, I went to the river, which is my practice, and some of that time is about prayer and wellness and being centered and being connected and feeding my relationship to the natural world myself. But it's not a one-way process. And so this week when I was at the river, I saw a very specific level of rebirthing post-winter, early spring. I saw this expressed specifically with the trees that along the banks of the Red River. The river itself is red largely because of the sediment that it carries, and more specifically because of the iron and some of the minerals and the oxidation in the sediment carried by the river. The river was more red than I had ever seen it.
The team created the following audio made up of Camilo Smith, Lois Volta, Rob Grace, Gladys Nobrega, Jacqueline Milestone, and Gabriela Daza. The subject is gun control.
This show focuses on our culture's relationship with firearms in the midst of horrific gun violence. You'll hear from gun safety organizations, people who choose to own a gun, the conflicts that lie in our hearts and minds as we examine our feelings about guns, and hear from those who see the world without them. I'll share a personal story about living in my neighborhood, Germantown, Philadelphia, and the effects of one particular crime and how it had me questioning having a gun myself. I'm your host, Lois Volta, and this program has been brought to you by the Education Department of WPEB. When we take the time to think about how we feel about the issues and policies of gun control, I can't help wanting to hear what people are saying on the ground level in our city. What are the people with microphones saying? What are the people who rally around them? What are they listening to? I want to be on the pulse, closer to the stage. I'm listening.
On March 26th, Not On My Watch organization exposes gun violence outside of City Hall and pleads to hold Mayor Kenney and District Attorney Larry Krasner accountable. The group Uhuru joins them in demanding programs for children and paying jobs for the youth. With the highest record of murders this year, when will the city officials recognize that the citizens of Philadelphia matter?
From another side of the community is Gladys Harlow talking with Mike, 20 years old, about how he speaks up about the use of guns and how it has affected him and his peers.
How has the issue affected you of youth having guns in their hands?
Well, it hasn't too much affected me, but it has affected my peers and everyone that's around me, because I live in the area and I see it every day. So basically what it do is, it's a hard thing. Basically the trenches is everything in the West Philly area, where these kids just run around with different guns and stuff, and it's real wild, super duper wild. And they get it from the rappers and all these dudes that they looking up to and everybody. It's nonsense.
What do you think we can do to help the kids or support them?
More youth programs, more youth educators, more stuff that the kids can do to keep themselves proactive, instead of them being in the house playing games all day, learning from Grand Theft Auto, learning from Call of Duty, learning from stuff like that. Me and myself, I box. There's a lot of young dudes out here that's in this area that fight on the street. Why not fight for money? Get them a chance. That's all.
I love that. Any advice, anything you want to say to the youth out there?
Just stay out the way. I mean, look, be young. Be a kid. Stop trying to grow too fast. Be a kid. Listen. Open mind, open hearts. There's enough money for everybody in this world. Like myself, I just turned 20, so I'm not too old myself. And I drive a nice, very nice car. My own money, like, I stay out the way. It's not hard to stay out the way. It's not hard to not have a gun. Just do your own stuff.
Cool. My name is Christo. I use they, them pronouns. I live in West Philadelphia. So I did not grow up around guns at all. I grew up in Maryland, D.C. My parents who guns were not a part of their reality whatsoever. I did come to learn later, though, that my mom's side of the family is from Haiti, and guns very much were a part of their reality, just because of all the political violence and all that stuff that, you know, is still very much happening right now. But I did not grow up with guns. It wasn't until I was in college. I had someone that I was living with, who's one of my closest friends, started, collecting guns towards the end of college. So the house that I lived in, guns were very present. you know, they were like locked up safely and all of that. But it was like, I don't know, he was kind of the only person in the house that was like, you know, cool with guns. It wasn't like a non-consensual thing. Like, you know, everyone was like fine with him having them, but no one was really like into guns, right? And yeah, I guess a little bit later, I guess I got more comfortable just like with the fact that they were in the house. And he's like, no, you should like learn how to like use them if you really want. And I was like, I'll give it a shot. And so he took me and a couple other friends to a shooting range. And, you know, this is like Greensboro, North Carolina. The gun shop that we went to was just like super white and super, I don't know, uncomfortable. You know, being like a black queer person, you know, it was strange. But yeah, we like, you know, started shooting. And at the time, I suffered from a lot of like mental illness related things. And at the time, I was like not in a good mental emotional state. And just like being around guns for the first time and like hearing gunshots and like feeling them come out of my hand, like, was actually quite scary for me. I like kept imagining like being like, you know, shot in the head or you know, doing that. I just like was not comfortable. And after that experience, I was just like, it's not my thing. I'm not trying to, yeah, I'm cool with my friend doing it and not having them, but like, it's not for me. And then fast forward, like, I don't know, about a decade, that same friend still was in North Carolina, went down to visit him a couple of times, and he like has a piece of land off the grid and has like a shooting range outdoor that he like set up. And so gave it another shot and felt much more comfortable with it. And my views on guns had changed over time in that span of 10 years after reading Negroes with Guns by Robert F. Williams and learning about other Black revolutionaries and like the history of like armed, self-defense in Black radical circles. And yeah, that's really what changed, you know, started to change how I feel about guns and my relationship to them. Yeah, after this past summer 2020, when all the uprisings were happening, there was all of this, I don't know, I don't even know like what to call it right now. But summer 2020, I was living in like deep South Philly in like a really like white neighborhood. And I remember after George Floyd was killed and protests started erupting across the country, I remember like being in my neighborhood with my partner at the time. And there's just this white dude walking around my neighborhood with a Glock on his hip, you know, like on his waist. And it was like very clearly very clearly felt like a reaction to like what was happening in the political climate of the city. And it made me like super uncomfortable. And like more, I think more than anything, it made me like really mad, you know, like I feel like, yeah, I don't know, when I think about gun control and gun laws and like people talking about Second Amendment and all this, like, I feel like it's largely like a white male project agenda, you know, thing. And it makes me, I have a lot of feelings about that. And like, I started realizing like there are people in my community, like around me, who like own guns and like don't have my best interests in mind, or like see me in a particular way that is like not me, or like, you know, like, you know, no one's gonna, if someone like wants to shoot me, they're not gonna think twice about doing it, given these assumptions that they have made about me. So yeah, in September, I went to visit my friend in Asheville, or outside of Asheville. And we kind of like the purpose of that, not the purpose, but like one of my intentions in going to visit him was to practice shooting guns. Because by that time, you know, it was after the summer, by that time I had decided that, you know, I might want to own a firearm soon. So I'm like, yeah, just like to protect myself, my loved ones. And so I drove out to Asheville. We like shot guns. I felt really comfortable with it. There's one gun in particular. It's a Beretta Cheetah. It's like a 9mm short pistol that I was like, if I were to own a gun, it would be this one. And I told him that. And I was like, yeah, like, you know, if you like come across anything, let me know. Like, I have a little bit of money right now. Like, I'm down to do this. Like a week later, he's like, oh, hey, I found it. I found this like military surplus pistol. It's the same one. So I bought it. And it was a really interesting experience buying a gun. You know, from like just ordering it online to like having it shipped to like a gun store in North Philly, and like how easy it was, you know, that weirded me out for sure. But I was just like, all right, I guess this is what it is. Like, this is how it works, you know? And yeah, I guess also, like, I guess there was like a minor sense of urgency in doing it when I did it, because I do think and hope that gun laws are going to start to change soon, and that it no longer becomes as like ridiculously easy to get a firearm.
That was a portion of a conversation that Jackie Milestone had with Christo, a Black queer person, talking about how it feels important for them to arm themselves in the cultural context that we're in. Rob Grace interviews Kurt, gun range safety officer, who gives his perspective on what it means to train people to use guns safely.
It's a sunny afternoon in Narberth, and I'm here with Kurt to talk about 2A, Second Amendment and guns. Kurt, where do you work?
I work at a shooting range called the Gun Range in Center City, Philadelphia. I am a range safety officer, customer service, and shooting instructor.
And is there certification for that, or how do you get that job?
Yeah, to be a range safety officer, you have to get certified by the NRA. It's an 8-hour or 6-hour course. I can't remember which, but it's pretty, there's a lot of information. You got to get tested and actually pass the test at the end of it.
And how'd you get into that? What qualified you to even try to get qualified for that particular thing?
Just prior service, just a knowledge of firearms and actually being one of the few people that can safely handle a firearm.
Did you grow up with them?
No, I did not. My family is very anti-Second Amendment.
And are you an NRA member?
I am not.
Is that by design? Is that conscious?
Yes. The NRA was originally supposed to be just a civilian marksmanship program and then became so much more than that with, spending millions and millions of dollars, not even to help the Second Amendment, just to pay themselves. It's a pretty corrupt organization that doesn't even do what it was supposed to do in the first place. They're really not supposed to be lobbyists in the first place. There's tons of other, organizations out there that do the same, that do what they do. They're just supposed to literally educate the civilians about marksmanship and firearm safety. That's why the NRA is supposed to exist.
And do you know, how do PA gun laws compare to other states?
PA is a very, I don't want to say loose, but definitely they're very pro Second Amendment. It's a very red state once you leave Philadelphia, and even Pittsburgh is a red city. So you can own suppressors here, machine guns, anything you want, basically, as long as you go through the proper, fields and pay all the right money to the right people.
Where do you stand on limitations, or what would you like to see differently?
So we all want the same thing, less school shootings, less, firearm murders, all that, but I don't know, it's really hard to find that line where you're not breaching, privacy laws with this, the mental health and everything, and still, but also I don't want crazy people to have guns, and how do you actually do that is always, that's my question, I guess, is that I can't give you an answer, I can just give you a question.
Mental health writ large, or people with mental health issues, tend to get demonized. We don't have a lockdown, we don't have a monopoly on people with mental health issues and citizens with mental health issues, but we have mass shootings on a scale that no other country has, industrialized or not. And the reality is we've got hundreds of millions of guns. We've got more guns than people, and that seems to be the only sort of hard and fast fact that separates us, that gives any kind of plausible explanation for this.
I think you're totally right. There are a lot of guns in this country, a lot of, what people call military pattern rifles in this country and stuff like that. And from my opinion, a civilian doesn't really need to own an AR-15. That being said, I own one.
Yeah. At the range, I'm sure you get into conversations with people that are across the spectrum, but do you have to check yourself, or are you able to kind of meet people where they're at or talk to them freely?
I keep a very tight lip. And I usually tend to be on the more liberal end of things in terms of the Second Amendment community.
23 million guns were sold in 2020.
Yep. And most of them were to first-time firearm owners, I believe.
Millions, literal millions of first-time gun owners, many of whom had no training whatsoever in order to procure that firearm. And that's the scariest type of person to own one when it gets into that situation.
Exactly. So that is great, because one of my biggest parts or hardest parts of my job at the gun range is literally, we get new firearm owners in there. They just got their concealment license. They're very excited, cool, awesome. But But then they say things like, oh, now I can just go shoot people. And you're like, no.
My name is Allison Durham, and I am programming and production coordinator for WPPM LP Philadelphia, 106.5 FM, PhillyCam Community Radio. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production. We hope you join us next week, and stay safe.